Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.
This guy's double murder trial abruptly ended in a mistrial when the prosecution failed to provide all of their evidence to the defense. But now, Timothy Verrill is once again facing a jury of his peers, and I'm going to share the reasons why I believe this guy is going to be found guilty. Hey, welcome to Profiling Evil and this case review of the state of New Hampshire versus Timothy Verrill. It's a troubling murder case that has possibly three suspects, but the prosecutors are saying that only one person brutally stabbed two women to death in a really brutal, disorganized crime scene. Let's look at the facts of this case and see whether you're ready to share if you think this guy is guilty of murder or not. It might be too early, but we're going to check. So make sure you're hitting that like and subscribe button and ring the bell so that you're notified of all of our notifications when we release new videos. And please, folks, consider sharing us with your friends. Well, this double murder happened in 2017, and police quickly focused in on Timothy Verrill as a suspect. You know, I always find myself comfortably uncomfortable when a suspect is quickly identified. I mean, either the evidence is so overwhelming that other potential suspects can be excluded, or somebody has tunnel vision. And it's when that happens, that failing to explore all the possibilities before making a decision, that I get the most concerned. You know, I often speak about the sage counsel that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author, gave when he was quoting his fictional character, Sherlock Holmes. He said, quote, "It's a capital mistake to theorize before one has data, because insensibly one begins to twist the facts to suit theories instead of the theories to suit the facts," close quote. Well, that said, I think the state has this one right. And if everything public records are releasing is accurate, I think they're on track. Now, don't misjudge the facts that are in this case and the fact that it was all thrown out in 2019. Because in the early days of that jury trial, the judge determined that the state of New Hampshire failed to give the defense team all of the evidence that they were planning on presenting in the case. I mean, that just can't happen in a trial. So it was good that they threw it out and they started over. In that case was declared a mistrial and it sent everybody home to regroup. Everybody, that is, except Timothy Verrill, who's remained in jail awaiting the trial that's now underway. That means if this guy is found not guilty, he would have spent 6 years in jail for nothing. The criminal justice system moves way too slowly. Now, prosecutors say that Verrill was a paranoid drug dealer who brutally beat and stabbed two women. Their names were Christine Sullivan and Jenna Pellegrini. And he then stuffed their bodies under the porch like the trash, the prosecutor said. The state's going to try to prove that Verrill, who was probably high on drugs, believed that one of the victims was a police informant, and that was the motive for the murder. The prosecution has shown already this week a lot of photographs and surveillance video from the crime scene that place Verrill at the crime scene. His DNA is found on various objects inside the murder scene. Now, this proves that he was there, but it doesn't necessarily prove he did it. He's not disputing that. But the real evidence is putting his DNA on key pieces of evidence, like that bag of ice melt that he allegedly used to try to hide the bloodstains on the porch. Now, this didn't happen in Verrill's home. It happened in a place belonging to a friend of his, a suspected drug dealer kind of a business partner, and the victims. Now, one of the victims was a girlfriend to the guy who owned the house. And the defense, like most defense teams, is accusing police of a botched investigation, a sloppy job, stating that they believe there are other people in the home that were more likely the killer. So I want to just take some time and look at the reasons why I think Verrill is going to be convicted of this double murder. And as we get started, remember, these are only accusations at this point. He is an alleged killer. This is what the state's trying to prove in the trial, that Verrill, Timothy Verrill, murdered these two women. So we're going to go back to January 27th, 2017. Verrill was involved in illegal drug use and sales, but this guy wasn't always just a seller. He was a heavy user of drugs. And he was alone in the drug dealer's home with the two women about the time that these murders happened. The one woman was the dealer's girlfriend, and then there was another woman. Now, Verrill believed the girlfriend, Pellegrini, was a police informant, and so he decided to kill her. The prosecution's theory is that Verrill brutally murdered Christine Sullivan and Jenna Pellegrini inside that home at 979 Meadowbrook Road over in Farmington. And he used blunt force trauma and stabbing as the means to kill them. Just to kind of highlight this, Christine Sullivan died after she was struck repeatedly in the head, and then she was stabbed 8 times in the neck and chest. But get this, Jenna Pellegrini suffered head wounds from blunt force trauma. She was stabbed 43 times in the neck, the chest, and the back. And the evidence suggests that she was most likely passed out or asleep on her bed when the murder occurred. So keep in mind, Pellegrini was believed to be a police informant by Verrill. And that might explain the number of stab wounds she suffered, 43 versus 8. This was very personal. Usually these frenzied and focused attacks like hers suggest a more personal nature. Somehow he was solving a problem, but he was angry about that problem. Christine Sullivan, she wasn't asleep. She wasn't passed out. And this is evident by a couple of things, such as the location where her murder occurred, on the porch area of the house. She also had defensive wounds on her arms and hands, suggesting that she put up quite a fight, trying to defend herself, but it didn't work. After the murders, the bodies were stuffed under the porch in a really disorganized fashion. And this is really important in the case, and I talk about it on court TV. Verrill probably was really heavily under the influence of drugs when he committed this crime, if in fact he committed them. The victims, they were wrapped in various tarps and other coverings and then stuffed under the porch. Like the prosecutor mentioned, just like the trash. Earlier in this video, I mentioned that Verrill's DNA was found on a plastic bag that was tied to the crime scene. The porch was also covered with a large pool of blood after Christine Sullivan's murder. Now, the DNA suggests that Verrill used a bag of Prestone Ice Melt, trying to clean up all the blood on the porch. And that was because they got his DNA on the bag. When it didn't work, he simply threw a small rug over the stain, hoping that nobody would notice it. Now, the evidence at the crime scene also suggested that Verrill concealed a number of bloody items, including Pellegrini's personal items, the bags. There were things stuffed into a laundry room and trying to hide it away, pushed into the corners. These critical pieces of evidence support the idea of this disorganized thinking that was going on in his brain. The evidence in this case is going to also show that Verrill was a drug addict and that he was mixing all kinds of narcotics together. He was acting strange, according to his friends. And his friends and associates actually painted him as being paranoid and unaware of the things that were happening around him. It got so bad at times, his friends said, that they actually tried to get him to a doctor. One friend said that he told her that he was doing so many drugs that he was having delusional thoughts. Now think about this paranoid belief and the belief that she might be an informant. But his addiction was apparently too strong, and even as quickly as he quit taking drugs, he started again taking cocaine, crystal meth, and many other drugs. And these things were combined together. His bizarre behavior intensified. And the home and the inside of the murder scene support that. Now, the owner was out of town, but he had installed cameras so that he could keep track of what was going on in the house and around it. Prosecutors were able to obtain that camera footage, and they showed it to a jury, showing who was coming and going. And here's the deal. The camera showed Verrill arriving at the home where the murders occurred around 11 p.m. Now, it wasn't unusual for this guy to be there. In fact, he had actually lived in the home for a short time before all of this happened. He stayed there for a couple of hours and left around 1 a.m. And this is really critical because at 1 a.m. he goes over to another guy's house, a guy named Josh, who plays pretty strongly in this murder case. And when he was over at Josh's house, this is a guy that he also had involved in the drug trade. Josh indicated that Verrill was high on crystal meth. And he came in talking about and complaining about Pellegrini being a drug informant for police. He kept saying that she was a snitch and that something had to be done about it. Well, at 2 a.m., he left Josh's residence, and he returned like at 11 or 12 a.m. later that day. But where he did go in between was back to the home where the murders occurred. Now, I believe, fueled by his extreme paranoia and his frustration over the fact that Pellegrini might be a snitch, he approached the house, but this time he was trying to stay out of the camera's view. In fact, he also blocked the view of one of the security cameras. Well, at 4 a.m., Verrill is captured again on the cameras, moving back and forth between the house and the detached garage. And this is what's so weird. Crime scene investigators would later find that all of the ground level windows in the house or in that garage had been covered in green spray paint. Nobody knows for sure why, and I hope it'll come out in the trial, but they did recover two cans of green spray paint that had Verrill's fingerprints on them. So he's the guy that was painting the windows green to keep people from being able to see in. Well, shortly before 7 a.m., the murders occurred, and this happened as Verrill is seen leaving the residence at 7 a.m. He was seen on the camera wearing a trucker hat that was white that was later found at the crime scene with his DNA and blood on it, a flannel shirt, and he was carrying his shoes. Now, the phones of the victims show that they were alive right up until about 6 o'clock. Now, there were only three people in the residence: Sullivan, Pellegrini, and the hidden and hiding Verrill. Later autopsy reports would show that Christine Sullivan died from extreme forceful blunt force trauma wounds to her head. It caused intense bleeding on her brain. In fact, this is kind of gruesome, but one of the blows was so extensive that it fractured a huge part of her skull. And this woman, sadly, according to the ME, was alive during the time these wounds were being produced. Now, she was also stabbed in the neck and the chest. And the knife wounds cut her carotid, and they penetrated both lungs and pierced her heart. This woman clearly tried to defend herself, evident by the broken and cut fingers that she had. And it's believed that this attack took place somewhere on that porch area where that huge amount of blood was recovered. Now, Jenna Pellegrini was murdered while she slept in a bed. There's no evidence that she tried to defend herself. But like Christine's case, she was also struck in the head, this blunt force trauma that caused fractures to her skull and it caused brain bleeding. The medical examiner said that she too was alive for these blows. But here's the deal, and here's the anger and the focus that I want you to concentrate on. Verrill then allegedly stabbed Jenna to death, inflicting 43 wounds to her neck, chest, and back. And just try to count that out while I'm talking. Like Christine, he sliced her carotid and her jugular vein, and he pierced each of her lungs. She took such a beating that she also had fractured ribs. I mean, count out how long that would take to stab 43 times and how much effort would be involved in that. The evidence in the case shows that Verrill then tried to clean up the murder scene. This is by DNA and what was recovered. He then hid the bodies by wrapping them in bedding, dropping cloths over them, and a frayed tarp before he stuffed them under the porch. In fact, actually, pieces of that frayed tarp were recovered in the room where Jenna was murdered. After he committed the murders, it's believed that Verrill then returned to Josh's house at about, like I said, 11 a.m., 12 o'clock noon. He walked in, grabbed a beer, and sat down inside. And the only comment he made to Josh was, quote, "interesting night," close quote. Well, Josh and several others who talked to Verrill during that day commented that he reeked of body odor, something that Julie Grant on Court TV caught me completely off guard with as we watched the testimony unfolding in the case. So I want to just pause long enough to go to that segment.
Before we see the cross, let's just pause here. I want to bring in my guest, retired police commander, the host of the Profiling Evil podcast, Mike King, talking about how the girlfriend at the time of the muscle who knew the defendant, Timothy Verrill, sees him that night, sees the same thing that the muscle did, you know, no shoes on, the shorts. He stinks. She says, you know, he's got BO. Commander King, serious question. Does the BO indicate an MO here? Your thoughts. I had to do it.
Yeah, you know, what I think it really signifies, Julie, is this incredible state of disorganization, which I think the prosecution could successfully tie back to that crime scene, because it shows this guy in complete disarray. He's been living without taking a bath, obviously, for some time. He's been involved in something that's creating an enormous amount of BO. And you think about that crime scene, and the thing that I guess hits me as someone who looked at behavior in murder scenes most of my career is the fact that this is a completely disorganized crime scene, and his body, his reactions, the kind of testimony this victim or this woman is giving on the stand today all supports the idea of the disorganization that's going on, not only maybe in his mind prior to and leading up to the homicides, if in fact he's the killer, but the way in which the crime scene is displayed, the way in which the victims are just dumped and disposed of, not secreted and hidden away like someone who's been planning this, and then his disarray in his whole being as she sees him. I think it all kind of fits nicely together, and I hope that the prosecution is on top of that enough to tie it back to this murder. Otherwise, they're just saying the guy was messed up and he was in a drug house.
Mm-hmm. Commander, excellent points by you.
You know, it's really interesting to note that some of the witnesses that the prosecution is calling in this case are combative, to say the very least. They clearly don't want to be in that courtroom, and they clearly don't want to appear like they're supporting the prosecution in any way. But the prosecutor's doing a pretty good job of dragging the truth out of them. Let's watch that segment.
Well, this witness looks like she's getting kind of fed up with defense counsel here, really not hiding her emotions and her responses. Let's bring in our guest, see what he thinks. Retired Police Commander Mike King on the show today. Commander, what do you make of this witness and how she's reacting to some of the questions from counsel?
I was wishing that you were there helping that prosecutor, because this witness is really hostile, probably isn't the right word, but it actually is the category, a hostile witness that doesn't want to be there. She doesn't want to share the information she has, and he's having to work, pull tooth and nail to get any information out of her. It's kind of frustrating to watch, and yet it's such a cool part of the criminal justice process.
You're right, Mike. No, I love it. Watching these cases, it makes me want to get back into the courtroom. And when she kind of said, you know, to him, you know, yes, and, you know, that's what I said. And If you're saying it, that refreshes my recollection. Like, she's letting him know, you know, just keep your questions specific, sir, you know, because I'm ready to fight with you is what she's saying. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah. And so this lady, Mike, we just have a couple of seconds here, but I wonder, do you think she's doing anything to enhance the defense theory here, which is that someone else did these homicides besides Timothy Verrill? Do you think that overall she may be helping with that?
You know, I keep finding myself vacillating on that one, Julie. I don't know whether the needle's really moving one direction or the other, and what the real value is of her helping out here or testifying here. But gosh, I think the defense is in the best position so far to be able to say, look, there's a lot of people out there. How can you point and say, my client is the one that killed these women?
Exactly, Commander. The defense has to say the BO was not an MO in this case. I'm glad I made you smile today. Mike King, always a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope this is one of those cases where you head down the rabbit hole and that you'll watch this case come to a close. Now, it's probably only got about a week left, so TV and watch it. I mean, how would you vote if you were on the jury today? And I realize it's probably too early to ask that question, but I'm going to be really interested in your comments down below. In short, the biggest things to come out of this week's trial, other than all that powerful evidence, was that the defendant was at the crime scene. Now, the defense entered a motion, a crazy motion in my opinion, saying that there was no physical evidence that tied Timothy Verrill to the case. They said, in fact, quote, there is no physical evidence that ties Timothy Verrill to this case. There's no weapon, no DNA for him. There's a wide window when the murders might have occurred, and no motive has been presented, and there's no evidence that he acted purposely or recklessly. Holy cow, what planet is this defense counselor on? I mean, to me, this is an outrageous claim. His motive was that he was a drug dealer and he thought she was a snitch. His DNA was tied to so many things at the murder scene that he can't exclude that. He's on the camera at the time these people died, and he's sneaking around the yard. Well, the judge didn't buy it and said that there was sufficient evidence to show that Verrill perpetrated the crime. In fact, the judge went on to say, quote, there is substantial evidence to support that he was the only other person in the house. He gathered up cleaning materials after the crime. When police came to question him, Verrill fled to his brother's house and he changed his license plates. And don't forget about that white cap I talked about. It had Christine Sullivan's blood on it and his DNA. Close quote. Now, another big moment was having testimony come out in the court by a dead witness. That's right, a guy named Stephen Clough, a 54-year-old guy who died in a motorcycle accident last year. Audio of police talking to him was allowed into court. And in that recording, he talked about going to the house that morning because the owner of the house called him saying, hey, I'm worried the Verrill's over there and the girls are nervous. When he got there, he found that the garage windows had been painted green, and thinking it was odd and not being able to get into the house, he grabbed a flashlight and two guns, got a friend to come with him, and together they broke into the locked residence where they discovered a complete disastrous crime scene, including a bloodstained mattress covered with a rug. I think this case is going to be a really interesting one as the prosecution rests and the defense tries to point the finger at everybody else except Timothy Verrill. It does leave questions like, why did the owner of the house and the victim's boyfriend leave town at that particular point? Was it orchestrated? I don't know. And there are many other people in this thing that could be potential suspects, but nobody seems as probable as Timothy Verrill. And I want to know what your thoughts are. Hey, and I want to also remind you that I'm releasing the second issue of the 2024 BOLO this week. BOLO stands for Be On the Lookout, and it's our digital newsletter. And the only way that you're going to get this thing is if you go to profilingevil.com and sign up for the BOLO. keep in mind, I'm not going to share your email address. That's the only thing I collect with anybody else, and you can cancel at any time. So make sure you go over there and sign up. And also, if you've been thinking about CrimeCon, make sure that you take advantage of the special discount code I have when you register. If you put in the code PROFILINGEVIL, one word, into the discount code box, you're going to get a special rate. And I hope you do come and that we'll get a chance to see each other there. Now remember, you can find Profiling Evil on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and of course here on YouTube. And check out our audio podcast by searching for Profiling Evil on your favorite podcast platform. Hey, make sure you're hitting that like and subscribe button, folks. And thanks for your support of Profiling Evil. We'll see you soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.